Hi, everyone. This is Dear Analyst, episode number 58. And I'm super excited today to invite Krishna Naidu, who works at Canva, a tool that I use at least once a week. And I'll have him describe more about what that is. But Krishna, thank you so much for taking your time today to talk on the show.
No problem at all. My pleasure.
Yeah. So if you want to quickly just introduce yourself and also a little bit about Canva. I'm always curious how people describe Canva because I love the product so much, but I'm curious how you describe it as someone that works at Canva.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm Krishna Naidu. I work in the data engineering team at Canva. And, you know, when I joined Canva about a year and a half ago, and before that, I hadn't used Canva much, or actually I had used it once for my daughter's birthday invitation.
But, nice.
You know, that was such a small way of using it.
Right.
And I think that like technical people like myself use Canva a lot less than say my family members. So I had a barbecue one day and family friend of ours, he runs a small business, and he was telling me how he used Canva for his marketing, his brochures, and I was like, wow. And this was just when I was going through the interview process at Canva, coincidentally. And it was only after we have an onboarding program at Canva, and it was only after we had that onboarding session with the founders that now the scope of Canva became clear. And to put it in a nutshell, it's to make design simple, but also to get your designs out there. So whether it be a social media post or a website or converting a presentation that can easily fit into become a video, for example. So it's getting your designs out there in multiple formats and so that people can consume it. So that's where the power of it is. Yeah, not just birthday invitations like I thought.
Yeah, I use it for, I mean, so many things. I also, to your point, I'm not a designer. I always thought I was a terrible artist. But then in Canva, I feel kind of empowered to make simple designs. And I think part of it's because of all the numerous templates. And I do everything from like, thumbnail videos, video or thumbnails for my videos, to birthday invitations, to actually when I present at my company internally, I use like Canva slides actually sometimes too.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, but that leads me into the next question. So you said that, you know, Canva is being used by so many people and creating so many designs. And as a result, there's probably a ton of data that results from these assets being created. So can you tell us more about your role within Canva?
Yeah, sure. So I sit in the data warehouse team. So that is a sub team under data engineering. There are two other teams within data engineering. We call them the data platforms team, which takes care of the platforms and tools. Then there's another, let's say, that we call them analytics, but they're the streaming team. So they get streaming data coming in from all those users that you mentioned. So from the clickstream data, essentially. So they make it easy for us to consume that data and make it available to the other data specialties, the consumers of our data, which are the data scientist team and the data analytics team. So that's the overall structure of the data teams at Canva. Yeah, in terms of the volumes of data, as you mentioned, it's growing quite a bit, not only because we have more users now, more active users, but also because we have more product features in the product that we like to track and that we like to experiment with. So combination of those two really make it a nice challenge to have, a nice problem to have,
Great. So I guess as I'm working on the data warehouse team, I know that you are currently working on a really broad project involving build environments. And I was curious if you can tell us more about this project and what it's hoping to solve for analysts within Canva.
Sure, sure. So we actually have, I think it's around approaching 30 data analysts who are working on the data warehouse, working on producing models, data models, so that they can answer questions for their product managers or other stakeholders in the company. So at the moment, what we have is, so at the beginning, it was all good, just having one dev environment where they could build out these models. But now with around 30 data analysts working, you can imagine that, you know, a person working on three data sets, those data sets might be the dependencies, the prerequisites for another data analyst. So they're making changes to these data sets, which would affect another data analyst's work. So there's a lot of chance or opportunities for stepping on each other's toes, which will reduce productivity, which will increase errors, and which will make the whole development process for the data analyst much harder, because they have to think about, okay, I'm working on her models and his models are going to affect me. So I have to be cognizant of that fact. So to avoid this conversation altogether, we actually are working on a feature that gives each change that a data analyst is working on a separate environment, a sandbox environment, if you'd like, where they can make the change, where they have a copy of the data to start with, and where on which they can build their new models, on which they can test those models, and on which other people can review not only the code, the SQL code that they write, but also the output of the SQL code, which will be rolling out in the next few weeks. So we've been working on it. Our team has been working on it, and we'll be rolling that out to our analysts. So that'll be a big game changer, I think, for us as the team grows as well.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell us more about the mechanics of how this, how you created this, the, these environments for analysts to spin up? I know that you're using quite a few different platforms to make this work. And how did you architect the solution and ultimately realize that this is like the way that it would work best for your scenario?
Yeah, sure. So I'd like to say we're not the first team that have done this, so can't take credit for it. So yeah. We have inspiration from GitLab, another company that I think you've heard of, which are very innovative in what they do. They're completely remote, by the way. That's another nice feature to have in this environment.
Yeah.
But getting back to what you were asking, what do we architecturally, how does this look like? Well, the first thing that we make a lot of use of is Snowflake's feature of cloning. So Snowflake is, for your audience, a data warehouse platform, which you can entirely on the cloud. It's not available on-prem. And it takes a new angle on the way data warehouses are thought of and used as well. So they completely revolutionize the way that we handle the number of users using the data warehouse, which, you know, in the olden days, in traditional warehouses, which you would slow things down if a lot of users start using it. Mm-hmm. And if there was like a batch process that's transforming or loading data, that would entirely slow things down for the users and vice versa. So what Snowflake does is it effectively separates where the data is stored and the processing required to work on that data. So you can spin up as many compute resources that you need for each use case or each user group that you have. Mm-hmm. So you can give different compute resources to your load, different compute resources to your transform and your users. And there's no contention between them. What Snowflake also introduces, which we make use of for this personal environment feature, is the idea of cloning data sets. And what how they do it is they don't actually make a full copy of the data set. As you can imagine, we have terabytes of data. So making a full copy of all that data would take a while if we were to actually do a full deep copy of the data. So Snowflake does a what they call a metadata operation that basically creates another pointer to the data. And then as changes are made to the data set, each pointer just adds the diffs for the data.
I see. Okay.
And by doing so, it is able to keep two copies of the data with very low overhead in terms of copying. So making two copies doesn't necessarily double the storage requirements, which is great. So that's what we use. So when an analyst wants to work on a change, they would raise a pull request or a draft pull request in GitHub. And the workflow would work through the analyst submitting a GitHub comment. So they just say clone, for example. And then what it would do is it would use the PR number just to identify the build environment, and then create all the clones of all the data sets that they would need. And from that point onwards, whenever they issue a command to build something or test something, it would use the fact that they're working on that PR. So each database object, or I should say each database schema, is prefixed with the PR number, so the analyst knows that their data that they're working on for this feature is available here. And it also makes it easy to share that way. So yeah, that's what we use to get this feature going, the cloning feature, plus all the glue that we have to add in terms of integration with GitHub and writing the scripts to do the cloning itself.
What are some of the most common like operations or changes that analysts are doing within their environments that led to your team needed to build this solution in the first place? Because like you said, I'm curious, like when you said that you're not necessarily copying the data set, you're just doing a pointer to it. And so any changes are just kind of diffs, which I'm assuming uses something similar to like GitHub, like commit. When you do a commit in GitHub, it's like you get a hash, which just shows the changes. And it's a very small like file size, I guess, or footprint. Is something similar to that? Because I'm just thinking, like, if an analyst is changing like a million rows, like, how does that show up as the diff? I guess that's the one thing I'm still not completely sure about.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So, thankfully, we don't worry about that at all. Snowflake takes care of that.
Okay, gotcha.
So, all the smarts for that particular feature, cloning feature, are handled by Snowflake. So, we just have to tell Snowflake what we want to clone. We don't really necessarily have to say how. So whether they're adding a billion rows or one, Snowflake will take care of that diff. And even the concept, even the word diff, I just used it just as an analogy. I'm sure it does something way cooler and way more technical. The way I understand it. Yeah.
Okay.
But in terms of operations that analysts do, you know, they add... they might have a fact table, as if you can imagine a fact table, and they want to add three more measures in the fact table. So that translates to three more columns. So if they were to do that in the current environment with just one development environment, them adding three more columns might affect another analyst working on the same table.
Right.
But if they had this separate environment, totally sandboxed, they can then do their change with complete confidence, test it, take their time with it. And when they're ready, we can then move that new table to production along with the new code. So that's the intent. So yeah, they can do all sorts of operations mostly it's changing the structure of the table rather than adding rows.
Right. Okay. I'm curious, like, so most are, since you're requiring as part of this system, analysts are submitting PRs with their changes, and then that affects other downstream analysts who are using that potential data set. Did you find, or have you found that that analysts all know how to, you know, submit PRs and, you know, because I think there's this idea that there's this blend between what a data analyst can do and then also maybe what a data engineer can do. And it sounds like the person here needs to kind of have a knowledge of kind of both roles in a way. Or maybe Canvas is hiring analysts who know how to use GitHub and submit pull requests and all that kind of stuff. I'm curious, was there a skill gap, or did people have to relearn certain things or learn how to do this stuff, or were people already kind of pretty well trained on how to use GitHub in this fashion?
That's a great question. And, you know, that's a big, I guess, topic in, you know, the data space as well. The blending of, you know, data engineers and data analysts into something I think that the DBT folks coined called analytics engineering. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you're absolutely right. There's some skills required to treat data development more of, you know, normal application development. So things like you said, submitting a PR, creating a PR, getting it peer reviewed, writing tests to mm-hmm. make sure that what you're building is testable, but also gives a level of assurance to not break other stuff, writing documentation. So all these aspects that are commonplace in software engineering aren't as commonplace in data engineering or data analytics. So there's definitely a lot of skills like this that glue everything together that make the end data pipeline much more reliable. To your question, does Canva require all this as a prerequisite when they're hiring analysts? I would say the answer is no, mm-hmm. because the main thing that we want from an analytics team is their insights and their creativity and their at looking at data and to get the answers from the data. Mm-hmm. The rest can be engineered through processes, knowledge can be shared through training, which we have an extensive onboarding program at Canva for not only analysts, but everyone who joins. Mm-hmm. And they get all their access sorted and they go through videos, tutorials, and all that to get a good level of skill just to get them going. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's so much more that they need to learn, and that comes on the job. But for data analysts, the main thing is their core skill set of analysis, data wrangling that we actually look at. I put myself in the same category. Before I joined Canva, I hardly used GitHub, mm-hmm. even as a data engineer, so to speak. I hardly used GitHub. Most of my version control is just different files on my laptop.
I think that's how we all start. Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely processes to make it easier. Peer review process. You know, if we make mistakes, we always have a peer review. I also like to add that when you join, you're put together with a buddy. So mm-hmm. the buddy is your buddy. They yeah. tell you everything you need to know. No question is stupid. So I think all those things make it much easier for newbies or people who haven't really used all these tools together to get up to speed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. I really like how you said that, you know, things like learning how to use GitHub, peer reviews, these are things that one can learn from onboarding, taking classes, but that curiosity of being able to pull or seeking the truth from the data and wrangling yeah. data, that's something that's a little harder to learn in like a few weeks. So
correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess moving on a little bit and kind of stepping back, if you, I always like to get to the numbers on this. Like if you had to estimate the productivity, time saved, et cetera, from moving to Snowflake and working with this cloning feature, do you have an idea of like how much time or resources your team will be saving?
Oh, with this particular feature, I'm actually not sure. I mean, I can give you, like, moving to Snowflake was a huge benefit for us, just in terms of what we could achieve. I mean, we couldn't even build some of the large data sets in a legacy data warehouse, which we can with Snowflake. For this particular feature, I would say that it's more of a, it does save time, but it also increases the reliability of the pipeline because it allows analysts, it gives them more confidence. I mean, they built this feature in isolation. They built this feature in a sandbox environment where they have run tests on it and where they have actually allowed the peer review process to be more thorough. So the person peer reviewing can not only see the SQL, but also the new data sets. And they can see the test results of the new data set. So I think it saves time, and it might, let me put it this way, it might actually not save time because now they have the ability to run all these tests, which they weren't able to do so. But it saves a heartache or pain later on because then they don't have to explain to their stakeholders why the pipeline broke, because there's less chance of breaking. There aren't any delays to reports, or there aren't any delays to other reports that we have to provide externally as a result of this. But yeah, I'll try to get some numbers and maybe share them with you later on.
Well, yeah, just being able to provide peace of mind is already a huge, huge benefit because the last thing you want is, you know, a chart breaks and you need it for the next board meeting and, you know, people are scrambling to make things work. So I think peace of mind is definitely undervalued in terms of the benefit that this can provide. Yeah,
definitely.
Also, I guess in terms of process changes, are there, I mean, you described some of the things that analysts need to do now, peer reviews, tests, PRs. From a broader organization perspective, were there any process changes that you had to implement in terms of, I'm thinking just like communication, how different teams work together? Was there anything that, I guess it's still kind of being developed, but do you envision some, any kind of new processes within the organization that needs to change to have, make this roll out successfully?
I think, yeah, it's quite fluid. I mean, we started, where we started was quite rigid in the process. So analysts would get us, the data engineering team, to peer review their code. So that was a big shift as well, to distribute the ownership of these different data models. And, you know, in hindsight, we're like, why didn't we do this earlier? Because obviously the analysts are the best people. They're the SMEs, they're the experts. They understand the data, they built the models, they should review, peer review each other's code. So so we did that as part of the Snowflake migration, or just after it. But I think the reason that we were able to do that confidently was because as part of the Snowflake migration, we also started using DBT, Data Build Tool, which we can get into. But basically, it's, it allows analysts to write, focus on the business logic of their models. It abstracts away the dependencies between the models, so analysts don't have to worry about, you know, defining the dependencies anywhere. And it also abstracts away the data warehouse stuff, like, does this SQL have to be a table? Does it have to be a view? Does it have to be a append-only incremental model? So analysts can quickly change from a view to a table with just a configuration option. So I think what I'm trying to say is the tooling allowed us to be more confident in distributing the peer review process. So because, whereas before we would check the dependencies, the data engineers would check that Model C had all its dependencies in order and everything was right. So now, since the dependencies are taken care of by the tooling, we are much more free to distribute that peer review process, which is now basically checking the SQL is okay, which we weren't really doing anyway before, to the analysts. So, and this feature of rolling out where we have individual development environments for each feature will change the process in one aspect especially. So right now, when analysts want to migrate a change to production, the moving the code to production is the easy part. But if they're building like a 20 terabyte table as part of this rollout, then at present, what they usually do is they engage us to build that table. What I see going forward is they will build that data set, let's say that 20 terabyte data set, in that special sandboxed environment that they have. And once they've done all their peer reviews, checks, and all that, they can then push the code through GitHub, you know, merge the code, but also copy that table across to production, or even clone that table across to production. So I see this feature allowing more confidence in the build process, and therefore getting us out of the way even more. That's what I see coming, shortly, I think.
Yeah, so again, that goes back to peace of mind, that you know that what analysts are doing will not result in any errors because the dependencies are being taken care of by the tooling and not by humans, in this case, your team. Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
Interesting. So I guess assuming everything works out correctly and DataEng is not being tasked with doing the peer reviews and checking dependencies, what do you think you and your team will be focusing on, I guess, after these tasks get distributed?
Yeah, so great question. I mean, there's always stuff to do.
Right.
There's always stuff to do. So our focus would be more towards, we should never settle. I mean,
right.
We should roll out more features that increase analyst productivity even more. We should make sure that there are other bottlenecks that exist right now. So getting access to data, we should streamline that process. Mm-hmm. So if a team in Canva requires access to the data warehouse, they currently have to come to the data warehouse team, explain what they're trying to do. And then depending on whether they need access to sensitive PII data, that can take a few days, you know, just that conversation. So making sure that is reduced, that time is reduced, can be something that we work on. So it's in the governance space, I suppose. The other thing that we can do is making sure that we know exactly what is coming into the data warehouse and putting out statistics and observability on what is coming in, how fresh the data sets are there any delays in the data set? So that's a communication piece to make sure that people are aware that this data set is 3 days old, okay? Mm-hmm. And maybe we can set up thresholds and say 3 days is fine, but a week is not good. So then, and putting that information in front of the whole of Canva, saying that, okay, the data warehouse, 95% of the data sets are within the acceptable thresholds and 5% are out. So getting that observability, getting that visibility for the rest of the business is something that we are working on and that I think we will do a lot more work on. The other thing that I think is coming in the Canva space, in the Canva data space specifically, is making sure that the data sets in the data warehouse can be used for not just reporting, internal reporting, and maybe surfacing some of those insights back to our users. You can imagine a business running using Canva, and they want to know who's using which templates are the most common for that business. So mm-hmm. perhaps surfacing that insight back to those particular users. So those we categorize as user-facing analytics. And this is not just the data warehouse team working on it. This would be a collaboration between data engineering, the backend engineering teams, because at the end of the day, we have to surface these analytics in the product. So that's something that we are thinking about and that we'll probably get into. So there's a whole lot of stuff that we can do once we have more bandwidth, but also once we find more use cases as well. And it just every time I think that we're there, we're at a state where there's, you know, where we don't have much to do, there's always something else that we think of or some other team thinks of that we tend to work on. So it never ends. So it's always good.
Yeah. And I really like that being able to give users some of the stats too, because I, especially as Canva is becoming more collaborative, I'm sure there's a lot of people that want to know how often are my designs being used, shared, looked at. That's kind of interesting. Just a couple of questions before we wrap up here. I know that governance and getting users access to data is really important. I'm curious, like, how Canva handles data access to specific users, specific teams. How did you build out? How did the team build out that that framework for who gets access to data? Because that's I think that's becoming a really important like topic these days, especially like you just said, we're thinking about exposing some of the data to our actual users of the product. And so just curious if you can speak anything about that.
Yeah, so by default, the data access in Canva is PII, no personally identifiable information by default to anyone in Canva. So the data specialties, data analytics, data science, they do have access to PII, but those particular teams have also gone through extra checks, police checks and all that to get that privilege. So then we, if a team requires it, we go through a case-by-case basis of getting more information about the use case and getting more information about what exactly they need access to. And the way we generally handle those from a technology or technical perspective is we don't give them access to the data set directly. So for example, if they need access to the user table, just as an example, and all the checks, and we've validated that they actually need it and that they'll be kosher with it. So what we then do is we take that data set and put a view on that data set, just pointing to what exactly they need. And we portion it out into a different part of the data warehouse, and we call that data marts.
I see.
And only that data mart then is given to this team. So that data mart is provisioned for this team and they have access to that particular area of the data warehouse. That way we can easily see what special accesses have been granted. So we have a bunch of data marts now with for the enterprise team, for example, for the customer service team. So we can see what exactly has been provisioned, what data sets they have access to, and we can turn things on and off as required. So that's the approach we take. So in summary, everybody in Canva gets general access with no PII. The data specialties get privileged access because they tend to work on these data sets much more. And other teams, they request access and we take care of it via data marts.
And the data mart you said is just a part of some part of the data warehouse, you're saying?
Correct. It's just a namespace. It's just think of it as a separate folder with a pointer back to the data that they're after.
Does the data access expire after a certain period of time, or just depends on the need of the team?
Yeah, it depends on the need of the team. So far, none of the access if it was to expire, we would set that expiry at the user level. So if, for example, a team wanted access for 3 months, we would then set that expiry at the user level, and their login would just expire after 3 months.
Oh,
the data set will remain. So good question, though. But most of our use cases are like for teams that have this as an ongoing requirement.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Great. Well, I think that answers, that answers all my questions. One last thing before we go is I like to, at the end of my episodes, I like to talk about other topics that I found interesting from listening to other podcasts and reading other blog posts. And one podcast I listened to recently was from the Dev Discuss podcast, season 3, episode 3. The title of the podcast was called "Is Vim Worth Your Time?" And there's a guy from that works at Forum, which I believe is a part of like this company called Dev. He talks about how he first started using Excel with keyboard shortcuts, and eventually became a software engineer. And he was doing pair programming with another software engineer who was really skilled with using Vim keyboard shortcuts. He saw how powerful they were, how fast his colleague was moving, and instantly adopted the keyboard shortcuts and has never looked back since, never touches the mouse or anything like that. And I'm also like a huge believer in using Excel keyboard shortcuts. That's how I learned as an analyst way back in the day. And I love using keyboard shortcuts for any tool I use today. Do you have a similar story or experience with keyboard shortcuts in tools you've used in the past or today? Just curious.
Yeah, I mean, nowhere as cool as what you just described as this guy who uses Vim so much so that he doesn't have to use his mouse at all. I am definitely a mouse person.
Okay.
And I use Vim when I have to, and not by default. It's not my go-to editor. My go-to editor, I have two at the moment, Sublime and VS Code. Mm-hmm. And thinking of keyboard shortcuts, the thing that comes to mind in Sublime especially is multi-line editing, which I use quite a bit, especially for large, not find and replaces, but large scale edits, but with a pattern behind it. So that's the one that I can think of. Multi-line edits. If you Google that, you'll get the keyboard shortcuts. But let me see if I can remember. It's on a Mac. I use a Mac. So Sublime, it is Command Shift. So you highlight, you select what you want, like select three lines, for example. Command Shift KL puts a cursor at the end of every line.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can highlight the word using Command D, and then you can essentially start typing now. And if you start typing, it'll change all three lines, all the lines that you selected at the same time. And if you had different content that you wanted to put in different lines, then you would copy from other lines with different content. So the example that I gave earlier was putting the same content on every line. So if you wanted to, you could then have a list of words that you wanted to replace, and then you would use that list, which would be different, and paste it on each line at the same time. So that's one thing that comes to mind.
Is that something that you can also use? Like I can imagine when you have like a bunch of code that might have like a bunch of variables you want to replace. Is that different from that, where it's like you're finding and replacing a bunch of variables?
You could definitely do that. I mean, you can do that obviously using find and replace, but you could also select all words, all variables of the same name using a shortcut. I think it's Command D to select each occurrence of it. And then it'll place a cursor on each of those variables that it found in your file. And then you could type over them and it would change that as well. It's really cool.
I see.
It's one of the features that I use in Sublime quite a bit.
Okay. Do you remember how you discovered that, and like what kind of light bulb went off in your mind saying, oh my God, I have to use this now going forward?
Yeah, I mean, how I discovered it, I think it's one of the promoted features in Sublime. You go to their website,
Oh, I
that's
see. Okay.
the screenshot that they show, and it grabbed my attention when I saw that, and I was like, oh, I need to find out how to do that,
Oh,
because
awesome.
Sublime's a great editor, by the way.
Yeah, I still use it and for all my tech stuff, but I know VS Code is becoming very popular these days. So, but
Yes,
you
it
obviously you
is.
use both, so it's good that you have both in your tool set.
Yeah. In
Yeah.
VS Code, I don't really have a keyboard shortcut, but what I found really helpful is the find and replace with regex over multiple files. So in my line of work, I might have to change thousands of files, make a small change to thousands of files. So then what I do is I look for a pattern across a bunch of files, and then you can add variables to your regex, and you can actually
Right.
substitute those variables with whatever you want to replace. So it's not just a straight find and replace, it's a find and replace with variables. So you can change one. So basically, all the context has to be within that file. So if you want to change, if it says Bob there and you want to put that Bob in line three, then you would select all three lines and then make the place where Bob is a variable, and then put that variable in the third line. And you can make that change across, as many files as you want. That's really powerful.
And that's not in Sublime though. You're saying that's in VS Code?
Yeah, that's in VS Code.
Okay.
I don't think it's in Sublime. Could be
Okay.
wrong, but yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I think I feel like once you, at least for me, once I discovered like one or two shortcuts, at least when I was using Excel and now with like text editors, it's like you can ne never go back to, I guess for me, I can't go back to the mouse, but having the mouse once in a while is still good if you just
Yeah.
need to get things done. Yeah. Well,
Cool.
this was a really great. Thank you so much for your time and all your insights today. And looking forward to continually using Canva and hopefully seeing some statistics about my usage in the product one day
Yeah, definitely.
at the help of your team.
My pleasure. It was great. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.